Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 166. America, you've waited a whole week. Actually, you've waited probably about 24 to 36 hours since my newsletter, tinyletter.com/WilliamFLeach. I hope all Grierson Leach listeners are subscribers. It's free. It costs you nothing. I find it weird that anyone would charge for a newsletter, but what do I know? Anyway, it's free. I ranked the 10 Wilco studio albums. Tim Grierson, he's the guy on the other end of this call. How's it
Hello,
going?
Hello, I did. Yes, I read this with interest.
Yes, so Tim Grierson wrote a book Sunken Treasure. I'm trying to promote your book, Grierson.
I know.
Sunken Treasure is a book that Grierson wrote about Wilco. And I've been waiting. This could be a whole three-hour podcast, so we're not going to do this. But I ranked my 10 Wilco, my 10 Wilco albums. I'm curious, Grierson, as someone that literally wrote the book on Wilco, do you think I did okay with the rankings? Just for the listeners at home, five what was five?
It was in 5 a.m.
Summer Teeth.
Oh, Summer Teeth.
A.m. Five was a.m. You're right. Five was a.m. Four was Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Three was Sky Blue Sky. Two was Being There, and one was A Ghost Is Born. Whether or not you agree, lock and letter to those. Was that an embarrassing ranking of the five?
No, I don't think it was embarrassing at all. I think maybe AM's a little high. I'm not as big a fan of AM as you are. I actually like Whole Love and Wilco the Album as much as some of the other ones that you mentioned. But yeah, no, I thought it was a very solid list, and it was very nice what you wrote about me and my writing and the book, which I appreciate. So where would you, this is my question, we discussed this offline many months ago. So where did the Mermaid Out, where would Mermaid Avenue, let's just say the first volume, if you had to put that in the rankings, where would that go?
I've listened to those a lot, but like I've been doing like deep dive on all the Wilco albums, including Schmilko, which was 10 on my list. Would Schmilko be 10 on your list?
I actually like it better than Star Wars.
Okay, so Star Wars would be... I think those are roughly around the same spot. I would say I would put it probably above... probably above AM is probably where I'd put it. I'd probably put it five. That would take over AM's spot.
Yeah, because I'm a big fan of Mermaid Avenue. I like that quite a lot. And, it's not for nothing that I think in some ways it's because they have somebody else to bounce off of. Not just... Woody Guthrie, but also I think Billy Bragg. I think the juxtaposition of those two voices works really well on that album. But
okay,
but yeah, and, that was a pretty solid ranking. I think I think what's interesting about Wilco, just real fast, is that I think consensus wise, critically in terms of their standing, most people would say Yankee Hotel Foxtrot is the best. I wrote about my own kind of reservations with that album, and you have your own reservations. And if you don't think that's their best album, then you kind of have your pick, and there's such a varied like collection of albums that you can kind of like have your own, what more speaks to your own personality, I think, will inform which album that you go for is your favorite.
Yes. And my personality is the one that's right about everything, so therefore it goes to this point.
I think most of our listeners could have guessed.
Yes, exactly.
I was glad you had Sky Blue Sky as high as you did, which I think is a very underrated album in their collection.
I was emailing with my friend Ben Lindbergh, who is on the Effectively Wild podcast and is on the Ringer MLB podcast. He is a huge Wilco fan as well. And he was like, "Well, I bet in a couple of years you're going to regret having Sky Blue Sky number 3." And I'm a little worried he might actually be right.
Meaning it should be higher is what you're saying.
Yes, it should be higher.
What you're saying. Yeah. Well, it has their arguably their best song ever.
Which I did mention. All right. So if you were wondering, can the Grierson Leach podcast possibly get any wider this week? We determined that yes, it in fact could, because we talked about Wilco to start the show. This is the Grierson Leach podcast, episode 166. My name is always to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Again, apparently on Facebook and Instagram. I don't know. Maybe. Email us, GriersonLeach@gmail.com. Go to our website, GrierisonLeach.com. Go to GrierisonLeach.com/RSVP. This is the list of every single movie we have talked about on this here podcast. The opening song is from Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue. I know Bandcamp, SoundCloud, clothing songs, My Friend Mary. Short songs on Melancholy Longings. Facebook page, My Friend Mary. We also have a t-shirt. Where can people get the t-shirt, Grierson?
I keep telling you, it's conbureau.com.
You don't need to add the little sign. We just need to say cottonbureau.com. Cottonbureau.com.
The check is the same amount no matter what we say. It's okay.
Yes. Cottonbureau.com. Type in Grayson Leach. You can get our t-shirt. Get yourself pork. Subscribe to us. You can do that. You should. Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to subscribe to us and get every podcast the second it comes out. If by the way, I want to let us know if something we're doing, making some changes in the feed right now. So if you get anything weird in the feed, or if you don't get a show, please email us GrissonLeach@gmail.com. Working on some, we'll talk about it in a bit, but the feed's changing a little bit. So if you have any trouble with the feed, please let us know, but it should still be working just fine. But the best way to get a new podcast when it comes out is subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts/iTunes. And while you're there, give us a review. And if you give us a review with the name of a movie you would like us to discuss, we will discuss it in our reboot section, which is something we used to do all the time and have not done in like a month, but it's back, baby. Woo, it's back. We have a reboot this week. It's a 3-hour movie, so I think it made up for some of the reboots we haven't done the last couple of weeks. The review comes to us from Scott Daltonic. Scott Daltonic writes, great movie podcast, 5 stars. Great podcast that goes fairly in-depth on current movies that doesn't cross spoiler lines. That said, they do give you thoughtful insight on the films, as well as the acting and where the film fits in culturally. I really enjoy their deep digs on older films as well. My ask for a review, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. So, as we ordinarily do not like to let people just review, put 3 movies in there for us to review, but we will, in fact, review The Good, we will review The Bad, and we will review The Ugly. I was waiting for Grissom to correct me. That's never mind. It's one movie.
It was. I was excited to see where that was going.
Nowhere. It was going literally nowhere.
It went about as well as Star Wars or Schmilko.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeesh. All right. So we have 2 new movies to talk about this week. 2 new movies to talk about this week. That we've seen all of them. We're all in what's going on. I want to ask you, actually, Grissom, did you see Missing Link?
I did not see Missing Link. I was unable to get to
it. Some people like Missing Link. Yeah, I'm unable to. Some people liked it. And I think every once in a while, we miss a movie that just like, because things get busy, we get stuff going on, and one falls through the cracks and people end up really liking it. But people tend to like Missing Link, right?
I think for the most part, I mean, I don't think it's as well reviewed as, say, like Paranorman was or Kubo and the Two Strings. It's like between that one and Little, which also opened this weekend, it seems like people liked Missing Link a little bit better than Little. I actually have not seen either of them yet.
Yeah, which is why we're not talking about them. I'm not going to make we don't need to have either one of us solo on Little, but certainly general positive views for both. I'm out of body switch. I'm literally body switched out for movies. I just can't do it anymore. And I'm also against, I can't do any more movies about evolution. So, because it's totally fake. It's what they try to teach you in the pagan schools.
He's kidding, folks. He doesn't mean that.
Of course not. Okay, that's true. Evolution. Evolution is real, Grissom Leach listeners. The fact that you were able to find this podcast proves that you are aware of that.
Right. You're clearly a more evolved member of the species.
Yes.
Simply
yes.
By listening or just simply finding this album. Finding this
to
podcast.
Figure out how the light machine on your table is making sound.
Yes.
It is not spewing demons across your world.
My grandson taught me how to iPad. Did you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine this week, Will?
I did enjoy that.
Oh, Julia Sweeney was fabulous this week. Yeah,
Law of Economy of Characters, total Law of Economy of Characters episode 2, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Whenever there's a character who, like, that's a minor character played by someone that I know.
Yes. So no Missing Link review this week, folks, but if you want to know our thoughts on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you've come to the right place.
And Wilco, speaking of... Anyway, okay, so our first new movie that we're going to discuss is Hellboy.
We're the line in the sand. We fight against the forces of darkness.
This is the Earth.
We're expecting a sign that says secret headquarters.
Oi. I need some ID, love.
Are you serious?
Hellboy is a reboot, not a sequel. I guess it's not a remake. I don't know. It's hard to keep track. And more importantly, it doesn't matter. It's directed by Neil Marshall, who directed The Descent more than a decade ago and has done a bunch of television stuff since then, including Game of Thrones. Hey, Game of Thrones is back tonight. We're taping this on Sunday. And this time...
I have literally never watched a full episode of Game of Thrones.
I have not either. But I am not going to be one of those dicks who's like, I've never even watched Game of Thrones, so I don't care.
So therefore, you're stupid if you like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, I just have to. It's like 7 seasons. I haven't gotten to it.
My parents love them. My mother has literally watched every episode of Game of Thrones 3 times. So she's excited about tonight.
Well, I'm excited to hear what she thinks of the new season.
Retired people are amazing.
as one would assume that would be the people. That's the core audience for Game of Thrones. David Harbour from Stranger Things plays Hellboy in this new version of Hellboy, based on the comic book. And in this version, Hellboy, there's no origin story exactly that, like the Guillermo del Toro one from like about 15 years ago. We sort of learned how Hellboy came into being. It's basically we start with Hellboy doing his job. He works for the BPRD, which he's basically a paranormal cop going after ghouls and goblins and monsters and giants and things like that. He gets an assignment that takes him to London. And on that assignment, he discovers that there is an ancient sorceress named the Blood Queen, which is a hell of a name. And she's played by Mila Jovovich. And the Blood Queen is being reassembled. She was cut up into a bunch of pieces way back when, because she was so powerful, they wanted to chop her up and put her body parts all around the planet. They basically stole the idea for this, by the way. Do you remember the Body Count song, Mama's Gotta Die Tonight, Will?
Body Count's in the house.
Now, if you have to be a certain age, I think, to watch Hellboy, this version of Hellboy, see the opening where they establish how the Blood Queen is cut into different pieces and put in a bunch of different places, and think to yourself, hey, like the Body Count song. She's being reassembled, though, by her evil legion so that she can take over the planet. The Blood Queen believes that her true king, her soulmate, is, in fact, Hellboy. A battle ensues, and wouldn't you know it, the fate of the planet is at stake. This movie is terrible. I want to get to that right at the start. This movie is absolutely god-awful. God-awful? Hellboy? He's demon spawn? Get it? Who cares? Anyway, the Guillermo del Toro film, the first one came out in 2004. The second one, Golden Army, came out about 4 years later. And whatever your thoughts about those two movies are, you owe those movies an apology, because this movie is so goddamn stupid that maybe for like the first 20 minutes I was into this film, or at least willing to meet it halfway, because obviously the key difference between this Hellboy and the old Hellboys is that those were PG-13. They were a little more kind of all ages appropriate. This one is a hard R. How hard R is it? There's lots of swearing. There are so many decapitations. There are so many people being ripped in half. This movie is very, very kind of bloody and really spends every single second telling you kind of how badass it is. And I wrote a piece that's going to come out over at Mel on Monday, where I basically wrote that there's nothing more boring as a personality trait than somebody who is badass. And Hellboy, unfortunately, is about 2 hours of people trying to prove how incredibly badass and irreverent they can be. This is the type of movie that maybe if you're 13 years old, you're like, I got to sneak into this movie. But then when you're older, you're like, oh, yeah, actually, this is just really kind of like posturing and stupid. Almost nobody gets out of this movie kind of alive. I think Sasha Lane, who plays a psychic who is a friend of Hellboy's, her character's name is Angie, I believe. And if you were, or sorry, Alice. And if you were a fan of the comic books, you'd be like, Alice Monaghan. Yeah, maybe. I think that's a character in the comic books. Sasha Lane is not bad in this. And I, you know, as someone who loved her in American Honey and is all behind her actually having a film career, I was glad to see her in this and see her kind of survive it. But this is only the second worst movie of the month to feature Kickstart My Heart near the very end of the film. What was the worst? Of course, it was The Dirt from Netflix. I hated this movie. I thought it was terrible. I'm still not giving it an F, though. So that one person who wrote me on Twitter and said, you better give this movie an F, I'm sorry, I'm still not going to give it an F, but boy, is this thing terrible.
Again, it's always a weird spot when someone, one of us starts off with, this movie's really, really horrible. The other person's like, Well, I'm not going to defend it because I'm not, to be very clear. And it's funny. One of the things you touched on, one of the things I dislike the most about this movie, which is the music. Like the soundtrack chosen for this movie feels like at one point randomly Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare starts playing. And for no, and again, if this was like going for, if this were, what's the Nicolas Cage movie with,
Spawn?
Tracy, whatever the hell it's called. The one, the way he goes crazy that came out last year. That's good.
Mandy.
Mandy, thank you. Mandy. If this were Mandy, like, that kind of musical choice could, like, make a little bit of sense, right? But, like, it's just the whole movie is just, that it really feels, like, randomly selected music-wise. It really does, the movie does feel like a pose. This is kind of what Logan spawned, right? Logan and Deadpool have spawned are movies like this, where it's like, oh, well, remember that movie that actually had like a little bit of that comic book movie that was a little bit clever and had some dark themes, but didn't lean into them very much to get the PG-13. What if we just went hard R? Yeah. But like, it has nothing to say. None of the hard R stuff is interesting at all. The violence is just stupid. Sasha Lane survives. I would argue David Harbour does his best. You can sense he's thought about this character a little bit, and he's trying to attach him to a story. Unfortunately, the character himself has not been conceived as anything more than just a sneering kind of like, this is so dumb and stupid. I'm pop culture relevant, except it's all from like references from like 20 years ago. It feels like old guys trying to be young teenagers in a way of a very Steve Buscemi hello fellow kids sort of way that is never very clever. I don't think it's Harbour's fault. I think he does the best he can. I'll give him that. There was a brief moment where I thought, okay, maybe Thomas Hayden Church is going to do something funny because he shows up randomly as a character named Lobster Johnson. The fact that there is a character named Lobster Johnson makes me think this is probably something that's funny in the comic book. I don't know anything about the comic book. It probably is funny in the comic book. It is certainly not funny here, but I imagine it's probably something funny in the comic book. Here is like everything else. It just kind of flies by the screen, flips you off and says, "Aha! Look at me! I'm flipping you off!" And then he just kind of run by. I don't know if I hate it quite as much as you do. It's not Warcraft level bad for me. I think I like David Harbour. Like, I actually think, like, I saw that he was cast in this. I thought, okay, that's kind of an interesting choice. I think he's an interesting actor. Maybe he'll do something with it. He doesn't do anything, but he tries. Yeah, that's at least you tried. So there's that. But otherwise, yeah, I'm pretty much with you.
By the way, because I do not know the comic book at all, it was a little bit of a bummer for me that a character named Lobster Johnson does not, in fact, look like a lobster.
Yeah, he doesn't even look like a Johnson.
So that was disappointing. So when did you leave, Will, in terms of the movie? Because my question is, did you see the little stinger at the end, and then yes, did you see the thing at the very end of the credits?
No, I didn't see the thing in the very
okay.
Way.
Well, that was
by
amazing.
The way, this is where we are with Hellboy, by the way. We're like 4 minutes into the conversation and already talking about what happens at the end
right.
of the credits.
Well, because I was thinking, once again, this conversation we've had many times where it's like, because, you know, this movie is long. It is way too long as it is. But when the movie you think is over and then it says, there's a title card that says, 6 months later, oh no, is there more to this movie? And what basically happens is that in the little denouement, or the little like kind of after thing, is that we discover, oh, they're going to hook up with another character that you may remember from the first Hellboy movie. I guess it's fun to see Sasha Lane like carrying guns or something. David Harbour, I think. You know, Ron Perlman, I think, was really quite good as Hellboy in terms of sort of establishing a character who is irreverent and a bit of a smartass, but at the same time, there was an attempt to give that character some pathos. And the idea behind Hellboy, whether it's the Del Toro version or even this version, is that he has no place in the world to call his own because he's half human. He is half demon spawn, which is a tough racket. I imagine that's pretty funny, but it's tough. I mean, that's who among us could handle such a difficult origin story. But there's at least this idea of he's an outsider, he's a loner, he has no place in the world. It feels like home for him. I thought that Ron Perlman and especially Del Toro understood that, even though that character was a smartass at the same time, there was this idea that there was a reason to kind of care about that character. I think the problem with this version is that Neil Marshall and David Harbour kind of are more like, oh, he's almost more of like a hard-boiled detective in this one a little bit more, and there isn't enough kind of humanity in this character to make you really kind of be invested in him. So that's difficult. That's a difficult like ask in this film. I sat closer than I normally do at my press screening for this, because I got there like a couple minutes before the movie started, and I could tell it was a bad sign because we were not in one of the bigger theaters at the multiplex we normally go to for these screenings. It was a smaller one. It was kind of like they were kind of like trying to hide us in the corner, it felt like. So I feel like I was really in the splash zone in this for this movie. And that was my point I'm trying to get to, because there is so much like just like before we did the podcast, you and I were fans of the movie Dread, which was a R-rated, hard R remake reboot of a superhero movie that was, you know, pretty bad. But Dread, I feel like it had had a tone and a stance and an attitude that worked really well. Where this movie just feels like, let's just keep ripping off heads of characters and have giants eat characters and have people like everybody that Hellboy meets is gross in one way or another. Like they're missing an eye, or their eyes are sewn shut, or they walk in a painful way because their like bodies have been broken in these weird kind of ways. Everybody that he meets is just sort of like disgusting and gross. And also, I have to point out, a killer plague is unleashed during one part of this movie, and a name we have yet to mention in this review, Ian McShane, who plays like Hellboy's adoptive father in this film, who is also part of BPRD. I want to make sure I get the letters in the correct order, for God's sakes, for BPRD. Like, there's a great moment in this movie. This movie is so badass that a killer plague happens in London, and he looks at the screen and is basically like, well, that sucks. And then he just gets back to work. Like, this is how badass everybody is in this movie. As my dear friend and buddy and fellow film critic Justin Chang for the LA Times wrote in his review for this movie, when that moment happened, he said, boy, Brexit is even worse than I thought. which is a great line.
That's a good line.
But it's like, it's like there's always like just like stuff in this movie where it's like, oh, that's pretty badass. Like, well, kind of, but it's everything is. And also, this is a movie, to your song choice comment, Will, that thinks like we need a moment, we need a song for the sequence where Hellboy is battling all these giants in this really like awful CGI overly done battle action sequence. What rock band of the times can most reflect a scene like this that kicks ass? Answer, Muse. Muse plays during that. I actually thought, is this fucking Muse that they're playing? My other favorite little tidbit in this movie is that they do eventually have a flashback where Hellboy does discover part of his lineage. And if you've seen the original Hellboy movie from 2004, you remember this. It's a different version of that same scene of back in ye olden Nazi times. We see that sequence again, and there is a blonde woman who is filming the sequence as it is happening, as the Nazis are doing their Nazi things. And I thought to myself, that's not supposed to be Leni Riefenstahl, is it? And if you stayed for the credits, and because I was contractually obligated to, because I was reviewing this for Screen International, where we always record the exact running time, it is supposed to be Leni Riefenstahl, but for reasons I cannot fathom, they have intentionally misspelled her name in the credits and also the press notes, which inspired a conversation I had with a colleague, which is, do they have to not use her real name because the estate would sue her? And if so, why would the estate sue her? It's not like she doesn't have a bad name already. It was just sort of confusing. But yes, that is Leni Riefenstahl in the Nazi flashback.
All right, that's nice. That's a little twist to this whole thing. I like the fact that, like, it's funny, the last thing that I'll say on this, because we've probably gone too long anyway, is you talk about all these disgusting monsters, and their faces are melting, or they walk back, or so on. Like, if you're going to have, like, that's part of the appeal. It's one of the things the movie's trying to do, is have, like, look at all these crazy creatures that he comes across. Like, you are remaking or rebooting or whatever a Guillermo del Toro movie. like one of the things that's really weird about this movie is, like, I felt that, like, there would at least be more nods to the fact that a pretty beloved, universally beloved filmmaker made two pretty universally beloved movies. You didn't, like, wink at them or nod at them. This movie doesn't seem to have any reaction to them at all. It doesn't seem to, like, nod to them or be a, or other than it, like, maybe skips a little bit of origin story. Other than, it doesn't seem to, like, nod to the idea that Guillermo del Toro made, like, two really beloved Hellboy movies. Frankly, I would have never heard of Hellboy in my life if Guillermo del Toro hadn't have made those movies. There never seems to be a nod to them. And then they have all these disgusting characters. And if you're going to have disgusting characters in a movie that is a reboot of something done by Guillermo del Toro, you better bring your A game on disgusting characters. I would argue, submit humbly to the court, Grierson, that they do not.
Yeah, no, because the monsters in those movies, in the del Toro movies, just in general, he's such a monster. He is a monster lover, specifically because he recognizes that, like, that he loves those kind of outsider characters. So even in the Hellboy movies or Shape of Water or whatever, like, there's sort of an idea that there's such a deep affection for designing those characters and understanding those characters. In this movie, it's just like, gnarly is a word that came up a lot while I was watching the movie. These are lots of gnarly, gross, I never got to the point of actually being, like, physically ill, but there were, like, moments in this movie where I was just like, this is just so gross and disgusting. Like, my stomach was just kind of like, oh, God, and, you know, we discussed in the reboot section, you know, a long time ago, the John Carpenter, The Thing, which is a great, disgusting movie, but this is just, like, a bad, disgusting movie. Sasha Lane did actually help. I think that she actually has, I think, kind of the right B-movie vibe for this, where everybody else, we haven't even talked about the most disgusting thing. We have to take a second to do this because I want answers to this. Sasha Lane's character is a psychic or something like that. And her, would you think, oh, that's kind of a cool power? But no, because what happens is that when she conjures up somebody that is going to communicate with everybody in the scene, it comes out of her mouth in this most, like, disgusting kind of way. And there's a sequence with Ian McShane near the end where my audience, by that point, which had it and was starting to laugh openly at the screen, starts to communicate with Hellboy. What is the part? What is coming out of her? Are those her intestines? Are those her insides? What is that? Like, what is the physical thing that we are watching that is coming out of her mouth during those sequences? I ask you, Will.
I'm sorry. You want
I literally want to know, like, is that supposed to be like her intestines? Like, what is actually, like, coming out of her at that moment? I seriously, like, I don't understand, like, what is happening during those sequences.
To quote our old friend Marissa Lodadio, disgust. Okay, Grierson, what did you give it?
I give it a D+.
I got the bell back, Grierson. Oh, I got the bell back, Grierson.
Well, welcome home. I forgot you're back. You're back. Yes. You're home base now.
D plus. That is correct. All right. So that is Hellboy. We agree.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That movie stung.
Yeah, it did. It is definitely no Warcraft.
No.
So I have that bar to clear. It's no. What's worse, this or Mute?
Mute is worse than this.
Yeah, I agree. I also agree that Mute.
Yeah, because Mute, I couldn't even, like, find anything like mock. That movie just sat on my soul and just, like, crushed it under its, like, boot. And this movie is, like, at least it's, like, in quotes, lively.
Yes, it is lively. I'll give it that. Speaking of lively, let's go to our second and final new movie of the week. That movie is Her Smell.
I look ill, but I don't care about it.
Something. She's a woman. She's a user. Her mother. She's a deadbeat. A person. A persona. I think I'm on a
Her Smell is written and directed by Alex Ross Perry. This is his third movie, by the way, with Elizabeth Moss. Made Listen Up, Philip, with her and Jason Schwartzman, and then Queen of Earth. And then last year wrote Christopher Robin, which I believe we talked about on this podcast. This is his, I would argue this is definitely his most ambitious project. It follows a woman named Becky Something. She's a lead singer of a band called Something She. They are basically, I think you would argue, the musical era is probably late 90s, mid to late 90s when Something She broke in. Do you think that's an accurate representation, Grierson?
Yeah, I think definitely by mid 90s, this band is around. Yeah.
Yes. So there's a band, the lead singer of the band is Becky Something, played by Elizabeth Moss. She, we see them, the movie takes place essentially over like about five scenes over. A little over a decade, I'd say maybe a decade, maybe about a decade of time, including some flashbacks where we cut back when the band first breaks through, where basically Becky Something, someone argued there is a Courtney Love vibe to her. I would say that is a superficial way to look at it. I would say that if, either way I'm describing the movie to someone who hasn't seen it, would say, think of Courtney Love, but only briefly, because the character I think has a little bit more and less even going on than that. She is the lead singer of this punk band, and when we meet her, she clearly has many problems. Substance abuse, I think, foremost among them. But also, and I think one of the things that really works about Her Smell, we'll get some of the stuff that doesn't, is she is such a big personality in every possible way that you basically, the movie is partly about her having these like huge, massive breakdowns in exhaustive scenes that go on for very long, where you get every single idea of what it must be like to be with this person and have your livelihood rely on this person. But also the movie is, I think, just as much about all the people and how they deal with her around her, from her bandmates to her ex-husband, played by Dan Stevens, who has to raise their daughter, who basically raising their daughter on their own, to her manager, played by Eric Stoltz, to a new band of younger people, that younger girls that she basically tries to kind of take over. She kind of, it's funny, it's interesting, you look at her seeing this new band, and I think in a lesser movie or a different movie, she'd be like the old person that's realizing she's lost her youth. One of the things that's fascinating, if not always effective, about Her Smell is you realize that when she looks at these two girls, this hot band that like adored her growing up, she's not looking at them as like, oh, they're younger than me and cooler. It's, oh, awesome, I'm gonna work with these people because they don't know how awful I am yet. And it is worth noting that Becky Something is truly, truly awful. She is also fascinating. I've talked before about movies where children are in peril. There have been monsters, there have been Godzillas, there have been zombies that I have felt small children have been in less peril around when they are around Becky Something in this movie. She takes down everything with her. She is disruptive. She self-destructive. She destroys everything around her. She is a black hole. And for, I would say, 80% of the movie. And then I think where that ultimately goes, I don't want to give too much away, but where that ultimately goes, I think, is a pretty daring move by Alex Ross Perry to really make us spend this much time with this character and try to not necessarily redeem her, but get her to a place where we are almost on her, not necessarily, if not necessarily rooting for her, at least empathizing with her. And I think there's several reasons for that. One is that I think she there is a magnetism that she has. She's certainly very interesting. She certainly has a fascinating mind that I think comes across. And I think the second reason is she's played so compellingly by Elizabeth Moss. At the very least, whatever your thoughts about this movie, it is quite the Elizabeth Moss delivery device. She's basically on screen for every second of the movie and is magnetic in ways that you wish maybe she wasn't so often. She is just a lot. Her Becky Something is just a lot for everyone to deal with. I like where Alex Ross Perry is going with this. I like what he's doing. I appreciate the commitment to it. And I'm glad that he basically follows it all the way through. He does not apologize for her, but he definitely makes her, it's definitely clear this is not someone that we should be emulating to any stretch of the imagination. But I think it's also, the movie is not on her side, but I think it does a pretty effective job of making you feel what it's like to have someone like this in your life who just takes and takes and takes. And there's this great moment in the movie, and you forgive me, I believe it's one of the, I think it's the drummer in her band, says to her, she's like, the worst part about arguing with you is eventually when it's over, you don't even remember that you're wrong. And that sense of what it's like to argue with someone who will give no ground. And everything you do, anytime you try to have a human reaction to help them or to try to find some logical common ground, it's just a moment of weakness that they will go after you for. That is very effective. I will say the movie is also very exhausting. Like, it's very difficult to watch. It is almost too good at what it's trying to do, in that it makes such a convincing case that this person is impossible to be around that it makes it actively and trying and impossible for it to be around. I admired this movie more than I liked it, but I could say I really did admire it.
I remember being younger and, you know, sometimes when Siskel and Ebert would talk about movies, I think it was more Gene Siskel would do this more than Ebert would. I especially remember this with Shortcuts, actually, weirdly enough. Siskel said, like, you know, for the first half of Shortcuts, I really hated those characters. I really could not stand those characters. And by the end of the movie, I realized that I loved them. And I have never actually felt that about a movie until I actually saw Her Smell. I saw this at Toronto last year. And this movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes. It's long. It is a demanding sit, but not the type of demanding sit where it's like, oh, it's so violent or it's about such difficult subject matter. It's just you being trapped with this character. And also, like, the sound design is very abrasive. It almost, like, puts you into the head of this, like, not deranged character, but definitely a troubled and impossible character. And I struggle with this movie a lot when I first started watching it. But I have to say that I really love this movie. I think it's actually really terrific. I think maybe the best thing that Alex Ross Perry has done. And everything that you said, I completely agree with. Except I would say that I think that if you are going to make a movie like this, you'd better goddamn stick the landing. And I think he does. I think that the last 45 minutes to an hour or whatever of this movie, again, we'll watch out for spoilers, but where it goes, I think it earns the patience that you have had to give to the character. Because I think in some ways the movie is also about how many chances, how many second chances and third chances does a person deserve if they are simply so talented, or because you are linked to them because they're part of your family. That's one of the questions that this movie sort of actively asks. When I interviewed Alex Ross Perry last year for a thing I was writing for Rolling Stone about this movie, he said, you know, I kind of can't get away apparently from writing movies about creative people and all the destructive stuff they do to everybody in their lives. I mean, Listen Up, Philip is exactly about that. And Queen of Earth, though it's not necessarily about creativity so much, it's also about how do you deal with a longtime friend who's kind of a nightmare? How do you deal with these people and, you know, people you're kind of drawn to, but also make your life absolutely miserable? Alex Ross Perry clearly thinks about this, maybe not so much in Christopher Robin. Though it's interesting that in its own way, that movie is kind of about, like, these things you can't give up, you can't leave behind in its own kind of weird way. But anyway, back to Her Smell. I think Elizabeth Moss takes all of the goodwill that you as a viewer have had towards her over the years in a different way than even, like, say, like Handmaid's Tale, which I would argue is more of a difficult sit because of how dark that subject matter is. But in that show and in this movie, it's kind of like you are so riveted to her that you are engaged in what's going to happen, even though I think A.O. Scott nailed this in his New York Times review. Like, this is not a movie about a charismatic, likable character. This is about an unlikable character. She plays a character that basically tells you over and over again, don't like me, don't like me. Basically, I'm a piece of shit. Don't like me. I'm a horrible person. And it's not even a thing where you watch the movie, at least for most of the time, and think, well, there's a good person inside her, but, you know, because of her addictions and because of her ego and because of her need to be on top of the world as she once was and her band to be on top of the world as it once was, you know, she's been clouded by these things. the movie kind of makes a pretty convincing case that she's kind of rotten all the way through. And I think that that's really bold. And if a viewer is willing to give it, if the viewer is willing to be patient with this and kind of go with it and kind of put yourself in the position of being stuck with kind of a nightmare person like this, I think that the movie is legitimately beautiful where it gets. I mean, in terms of things I saw last year at Toronto, this is one of the things that moved me the most. I was with a friend, a colleague, who is also a pretty cynical soul. And he said, is it weird that that movie made me cry at the end? I said, no, I don't think so. I think that's actually where it goes. And I think whatever one thinks about Alex Ross Perry's previous movies, which tended to be sort of cynical, sort of sarcastic, kind of, he is not someone who is high on life, shall we say, in terms of his films. I think this movie actually gets to a place that's actually pretty compassionate and actually is much more sort of loving and creates a community of people where a lot of times in his movies, communities fall apart and bad things happen to people who are involved in these kind of little groups. But in this one, there are different things that happen. And I think that it's earned. I have to say, I understand, like, I think a lot of people will be kind of where you are, Will, where it's like, admire it, but hard to love it. But I have to say, I actually was able to make that leap to love for this film.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did. And I get it. Like, I like where it goes. And I think it is. It's a slog, man. I mean, it is a slog. And again, that's why I come back to kind of admiring it more than I like it, because it takes gumption to make a movie like this. It really does. And I think I have to say, I was really not crazy about Listen Up, Philip, I forgot the name of it again. Sorry.
What, Queen of Earth?
Queen of Earth. Yeah, Queen of Earth. I really was not crazy about either one of those movies. I like Turin. I think he's not like an unclever writer. Like, I think he can turn a phrase. I think there's some talent to it. But there is something, I don't know. There was a little bit too much of, just so you know, everything is terrible, this is a movie that will remind you of that fact. I like the fact that this movie has more than that going on. And I wasn't sure what it did for the first hour and 20 minutes. So I'm glad that I stuck with it. I am glad that I stuck with it. I still think it's a lot.
Oh, without question. I mean, the movie, your sort of elevator pitch of, like, you know, think of Courtney Love, but not too long. I mean, this movie is, it's really loud and long and abrasive, but eventually gets to an amazing place. If you don't have Elizabeth Moss in this movie, exactly 8 people will see it. And even then, it opened in New York this weekend. It's going to open in LA this upcoming weekend. It's going to slowly kind of move around the country. I mean, this is not it's not going to be like a 4,000 screen release. It's just not going to be that type of movie. But I will say, I saw this at the end of my time at Toronto this year. And even at that point, it played a couple times. And, you know, the opinions of people who had seen it was very, some people loved it. Some people absolutely just hated this. They just absolutely despised it. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you kind of like movies that are kind of argument starters, this is one of those types of movies. It really is that type of movie where it's an experience and you may not entirely be happy with the experience. I think this movie also gets to something kind of great, which is this idea of, can you forgive someone? And I think that when we talk about, like, this obviously is a fictional band, though it's been inspired by not just like the sort of like the riot girl groups of the 90s, but, like, you know, Alex Ross Perry has mentioned, like, even like Guns N' Roses is one of the inspirations. Like, I think what also this movie hits on that a lot of music biopics don't hit on is the idea of, like, both the tedium and the anxiety and the kind of hell of being in a band and trapped with someone who's sort of a raging egomaniac. There is something that this movie speaks to, all those things that you often don't see in more kind of polished biopics and like that. But I really dig this movie. I think it's pretty great.
Wow. So you are definitely higher than this than I would have thought. What did you give it?
I give it an A-.
Well, yeah, I'm a B. I am a, not, it's not a begrudging B. Like, I'll put it this way. There were an hour into this movie, I was clawing my face off.
Oh, I was too. I was too. Yeah. I was, there was something I'm like, okay, I'm here. Okay, let's see where this goes.
Even while I was doing it, I respected the gumption of it. I respected the audacity of it. And thought, okay, I'm going to see if this thing pays off. And it does. I agree with you that it does pay off. It's just not quite enough to get me to where you are.
Yeah, it takes a piece out of you, this movie, which is definitely the type of blurb I'm sure that the distributor would love to hear. It takes a piece out of you. Oh, that
sounds like a lyric from Live Through This, actually. That sounds like something that would be on there.
Yes.
Okay, all right. So that is her spell. So interesting. So I'm curious. I'm very curious what people's reaction. Again, I like this movie less than you, but this is definitely a movie where I am very curious when people do see this movie, what they think of it.
If this movie had a cinema score, it's not big enough. They wouldn't do a cinema score for this. It would be lethal. The score for this
it
movie.
Would be, and listen, it would be mother. It'd be mother.
It would be mother. And listen, if people listening to this podcast see it end up hating it, I totally get it. I totally get it because again, like, this is an hour into it, I was still just like, oh my God, I'm not sure how much more of this I can take. And I think that Alex Ross Perry legitimately shoves it in your face in a way that often can be incredibly off-putting, but I think he's talented enough to pull it off.
All right, so that is Her Smell. Now we go to our one reboot this week. That reboot is The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly.
The Good. The Bad. The Ugly.
The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly is directed by Sergio Leone. It came out in Italy in 1966, but it didn't come out until the U.S. until a couple years later, when essentially this movie and two movies that he made before with Clint Eastwood, A Fistful of Dollars and A Few Dollars More, were all basically packaged as a trilogy. Even in fact, they were never actually a trilogy, but when they were released in the U.S., it's like, oh, it's a trilogy of movies. They're directed by the same person. They starred the same person. And they're all Westerns, so I guess that was enough to count. The Good, that's Clint Eastwood. He is known as Blondie in this movie, which is interesting because his hair isn't blonde in this movie, I guess, but close enough. He is the good. The Bad is played by Lee Van Cleef, who is actually known as Angel Eyes in this movie. He is very bad. And the Ugly, and this is not nice because he's a perfectly good looking guy, is Tuco, played by Eli Wallach. You know, for a 3-hour movie, this is indeed a 3-hour movie, though I'd like to point out it is shorter, supposedly, than Avengers Endgame, which is like 3 hours and 2 minutes, apparently. This movie is like about 5 minutes shorter than that. The story goes like this. Angel Eyes is on the lookout. He's trying to track down this guy who has a bunch of money. And he's like going around trying to find this one guy whose name is what, Wilson or something? I'm blanking on the guy's name that he's looking for, or
Tom Carson.
Carson, it's Carson, that's what his name. He's looking for a guy named Carson. Simultaneously, Blondie, Clint Eastwood, working with Tuco, played by Eli Wallach. And Tuco is He's sort of a bad dude. In most other movies, he would be the bad. I mean, just in this movie, he ends up being the ugly because Angel Eyes is so terrible. And they're working together where Tuco has a prize on his head. And so what happens is basically Clint Eastwood, he brings him in to a town, collects the reward money. Then the town decides to hang Tuco. Waiting in the wings is Blondie. Blondie rescues him. The two of them get away, and they split the money between them. If you ever saw the 1990s movie Dragonheart, they use the same plot line as they do in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's the only connection that this movie has with that Rob Cohen dragon movie. But what happens is that these three guys are going to end up on kind of a collision course together, because what happens is Tuco and Blondie meet up with the guy that Angel Eyes has been looking for the entire time. And this guy tells him, as he's dying, where a bunch of gold is. It's in a certain cemetery, and it's buried under a certain tombstone. Tuco knows where the cemetery is. Blondie knows what the name of the tombstone is that they're actually looking for. So they basically have to work together if they're going to get all this money. Meanwhile, Angel Eyes wants to go as well to track down this money and get the money for himself. This movie I saw years ago at the much-beloved New Beverly here in Los Angeles, and so I got to see it on the big screen. I haven't seen it since, and seeing it this time on DVD on my TV at home, which is decent size but is not a big screen, the movie loses a little bit of its impact, I feel like, seeing it at home. It plays on TCM a decent amount, and I always sort of skip it because I think, kind of like a 2001 or a Lawrence of Arabia, if you can see it on a big screen, it's probably preferable because you will lose something in the transfer. That being said, I was reminded kind of all over again just how much I enjoy The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And also, speaking of The New Beverly, which is owned by Quentin Tarantino, especially watching this movie since I last saw it, and since Tarantino has really kind of gone into his Leone period, I would argue, it's really interesting to watch this movie and go, oh, that part he uses in Inglourious Basterds, that part he uses in Hateful Eight, that part he uses in Django Unchained, and not just like specific scenes or kind of references, but the idea of letting time build. You wouldn't describe The Good, Bad, and the Ugly as an action movie or action-packed, but it has kind of a rhythm to it. And Leone sort of allows things to slowly build and then get to a point and then sort of dissipate and then something else happens and it kind of slowly builds. And that is one of the reasons why I think the big screen kind of helps, because there's a lot of kind of big empty spaces in this movie. It's a Western. And it's set during Civil War time, though it actually wasn't shot in America, it was shot in Spain, I believe. And the kind of like the big open spaces of this movie kind of hint at the kind of overall like languid kind of pace and tone of this movie. But all three actors are really are kind of like perfect in the roles. If you can get past some of the bad dubbing and overdubbing that happens in this movie, and it's tough sometimes, it sounds kind of bad. You can kind of get like sucked into this rhythm of this movie and kind of get swept away by it. What's funny is if you've never seen this movie, in some ways you actually have, because it's been so mimicked and parodied, and especially the Morricone music has been used. It's used in commercials all the time. Tarantino has referenced it in his movies. In some ways, you've actually seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, even if you've never seen it. It's really, really, really well done. It's not my favorite Western, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It does require getting in the rhythm of it. It is something that I've never seen it on the big screen, and I really wish I would, because, you know, it is definitely, particularly the first hour, it does take its time. It takes its time, and it takes its time to, but if you stick with it, and not that it's like easy to get out of it, but like it does take its time. And it's not, it doesn't always seem to be taking its time for any specific reason, right? Like, it's not like we're taking a lot of time so you can get to learn this character's backstory or this sort of thing. It's actually taking its time to just really kind of envelop you in its world. And so then in the second half, or I would argue really the last third, when everything just starts really rolling, it's you're so much swept up in it that it's hard to even, you feel like you're actually kind of living inside it a little bit. And part of that feeling of living inside it is, as you kind of alluded to, this is a movie that's become such a part of the popular culture that it's hard to find things that aren't influenced by it, particularly in a Tarantino and post age, right? Like, I think in maybe like the mid 80s, you could have gotten away. Like, you'd see Eastwood, but like, it didn't feel like there was a lot of like people like aping these sort of Westerns in a way that Tarantino kind of ushered in a little bit. And now it's been like sanitized for commercials, as you talk about. But like, you know, the one of the things I really like about this movie too is there's a coldness and a meanness to it that is almost like nature. I think I've discussed this before. Something I like about movies is when everyone, the world is just sort of pitiless. Meanness is the wrong word. It's pitiless. It's irrelevant to whatever you're doing and whatever your thoughts about it are. Right? The world is what it is and life is what life is. And sometimes it will eat you alive and sometimes you will make it through. But whatever happens to you is does not matter to the vast spectrum of the universe or nature or the world or the very cold kind of mean West that we see here. And I really admire that. And one of the things I think elevates this, in addition to being like a really good tale well told, something that elevates it too is the fact that this movie's all taking place during the Civil War. And the Civil War, you know, has been, I mean, if you're gonna, there's a battle sequence involving the Civil War. If you're going to do that, even if you're making your movie in Italy with Italian actors, that requires a certain bit of ambition and gusto to be able to even try that. But one of the things I love about it is, one thing that the good, the bad, and the ugly can all agree on is all these people who are killing each other for nothing are stupid. And it's something that, like, I kind of really admired about it. And I think Blondie is the only one that seems to be a little bit touched by the sacrifice of some of these soldiers. But on the whole, in the Civil War, it's hard to find a war that's not more noble than the Civil War. Like Civil War and World War II, good causes, important causes, good job. I'm glad the good guys won in those. But what's kind of fascinating about this movie is all that this massive, epic, earth-changing battle that's going on is basically kind of irrelevant to these three people trying to get these gold, and they wait for them to stop killing themselves for nothing or what they perceive as nothing so they can just go about their own kind of business. And there's something kind of fascinating by that, fascinating about the idea that, like, I don't think the movie's necessarily on the side of the people that don't care about the war, but it also the idea of, like, what are you guys even doing? What are you guys even doing here? You're fighting for this bridge that we're just going to blow up in a second anyway. And I think that there is something fascinating and really kind of existential about it in a way where, like, you know, imagine if Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were actually involved in this, like, 3-hour battle to get gold in the midst of all this other stuff going on. I found those things that I really loved about this movie is, oh yeah, also, meanwhile, at the Civil War going on, and it makes almost this massive battle as opposed to what these three kind of, like, all kind of smarmy kind of jerk guys, with Blondie being the good, I suppose, are up to. It almost makes the war feel kind of beside the point in a kind of a humanistic way that I thought was really kind of interesting.
Yeah. And also, as you just were sort of mentioning, it's sort of ironic that the character who's the good, because, I mean, Blondie's not that good. I mean, he's fine. He is the not bad is kind of the better way of sort of putting it in this movie. And yeah, I mean, that's sort of like the you know, nature's indifference to what's going on around them, I think is actually pretty apt. I will say, though, that the penultimate sequence, basically before they get to the cemetery, spoiler alert, they get to the cemetery, that Civil War sequence I think is not as strong, and I actually think it detracts from, I mean, they're so close to the what's that, I was thinking the Poochie episode of The Simpsons, like, do they ever get to the fireworks factory? Like, they're so close to the fireworks factory, and I think that while, like, thematically I get why there is that kind of digression and what that's about sort of thematically and narratively, it does feel like it kind of stalls the momentum before we get to the ending. But that's probably like my one kind of major quibbles. This movie has existed in different forms and been like recut, and there's been like shorter versions that were in the US for a while. How did you watch this on iTunes, Will? How did you see this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's out, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it on the DVD that came out a few years ago, and, you know, we both, I'm pretty sure, watched the exact same version of it. But, you know, there were earlier versions, it was chopped down. I would not be surprised if that one sequence was chopped down, because it doesn't feel as vital to what's going on as everything else. Also, just like in terms of production design, how the damn thing shot, it's widescreen, but also just like the interiors of places look really, really cool. I listened to a little bit. There were two audio commentaries, and the late film critic Richard Schickel is on one of them. He sort of talks about how the production design in the movie is not realistic, meaning that it's not like the places look more fabulous than they probably would in real life, but it doesn't matter because it kind of speaks to the grandeur that the filmmaker is going for. And I think that's actually kind of well said. There's something about this movie that feels, I mean, it's 3 hours, first of all, but it feels epic in kind of the best ways. And we sometimes talk about this idea of like, well, an old-fashioned kind of movie or movies they don't make much anymore. I have major issues with Hateful Eight. You do as well. But that movie is trying to be an old-school epic in the way that this movie just kind of naturally is. It feels like it's kind of a shock that there's not an intermission in this movie. It feels like there should be an intermission because there's actually a moment that happens exactly halfway through where I thought, oh, is this where the intermission is? Because it feels like it could just do that. And it has that kind of feel. And to your point about how slow it gets going, not until like the first full half an hour do you actually meet all the characters and establish who they all are. But even then, you don't necessarily know how they're going to interlock and how their destinies are kind of linked together. It's got its pulpy qualities. It is a movie when you watch it now, you think, oh, not only did Tarantino borrow a lot from this, I know what he loves about this movie. There are things that maybe I don't necessarily love about Tarantino's movies that I know that he loves because they are in this movie. It has kind of a pulpy quality. Eli Wallach is sort of the comic relief in certain ways in this film, and sometimes he's a little too jokey for my taste. But on the whole, it's like, if Her Smell is a movie that you sort of sit through and you kind of like grit your teeth to go through it, this is when you almost kind of like sit back and let it kind of envelop you and you say, okay, 3 hours, this is what I'm doing. I'm watching this. And, it's long, but the way it just kind of flows from one sequence to the next. And there's actually like plot stuff that happens. I actually had forgotten some of the twists and turns that occur in this movie. And so it's not as if nothing happens in this film. It's not some sort of like existential journey about, humanity and the ways of man. There's shit that's happening in this movie. And so it's exciting and kind of you're carried along by the story as well.
Yeah, I want to talk about Eastwood a little bit to kind of close out, because obviously Eastwood, he has no threesomes in this movie, so it's not the mule. But
this is idea for a reboot. Idea for remake of Good, Bad, and the Ugly. Yeah.
Definitely. I'm curious. It's just the good, the bad, and the ugly doing it for 3 hours. Anyway, the point is that Eastwood in this movie, it's funny. There is something. This is the last movie he would make with Sergio Leone, and I kind of like when you read the backstory of it, how he got like a higher. Eastwood was already a burgeoning capitalist, and would get like a higher percentage of this movie than he probably should have, and they kind of annoyed Leone, and they end up not working together. And when Sergio Leone was working on Once Upon a Time in America, he like gave this interview where he like trashed Eastwood, saying he is like, because he was working with De Niro at the time. He's like, De Niro is like, he's a maestro of emotions, and Eastwood has like one maybe two things he can do. That whether or not you believe that to be true, that thing that he does is incredibly effective in this movie. There is something about him in this movie that feels like a mountain. Like he feels like there's something about him feels like he is this eternal figure that has been around since the beginning of time. And it's a hard thing to kind of describe. And it's this kind of Americana thing too. Like there's definitely something about him that feels like carved out of granite and part of like the American story in a way that even though he doesn't really talk very much and he's not really like this likable, he's not always this likable guy. There's something about him and specifically the way that Eastwood plays him that is, it just feels eternal. It feels like, how was there American pop culture without Clint Eastwood? I found myself watching this movie thinking that, did this archetype obviously existed before Eastwood, like Humphrey Bogart and stuff like this, obviously John Wayne, but something about Eastwood, John Wayne was obviously a great cowboy and a great movie star, but there's still something like there is something about Eastwood that feels, I don't know if dangerous is the right word, but like darker in a way that is that I think adds something to that cowboy character that ties it to this something in like the American character that feels like right and epic and eternal. I mean, does this make sense to you, Grayson?
Yeah, I mean, I think what that thing is that you're kind of wrestling or trying to find is or talk about is he gives away less. There is something that is very stoic and reserved about Eastwood. As you were saying this, I was looking it up. When the movie came out, he was 36, at least when it came out in Italy, he was like 36. And that's relatively young, but he does not even seem like a kid. You know, there's something about, like, he seems like eternal, like you put it, but there's nothing necessarily youthful about him. He already seems like a full-grown, like use one of these sports cliches I absolutely hate. Like, he's like, you know, like, he, you know, he plays man ball. You know, he's like a real man, and he has that kind of thing, and John Wayne obviously did too, but there's something that just feels so withdrawn about him that you, you know, even though he's the good in this movie, you don't necessarily, he does not come across as easily heroic. There is something that, again, like there's something like,
and you can tell that he's capable of horrible things if pushed.
Yeah, and he, you know, he is not easily tricked in The Good and the Bad and the Ugly because he believes in the better nature of human beings and is proven incorrect by the other characters. He walks in the same world that they do, and so he knows how they operate. And just the battle between Blondie and Tuco in terms of getting information or not getting information, and people trying to trick other people in terms of getting information about where the gold is. Blondie is no dummy. He is not naive. He knows he is alive and he has not been killed yet because he knows how to kind of operate. I mean, the character who is the good in this movie basically lets another guy die because he's doing the same scam with another character, but then he gets ambushed and he's, I forget the other character's name, but he's like, yeah, sorry, whatever your name is, as he's then taken away. And that guy basically gets hung because Clint Eastwood can't help him because he's being sort of taken hostage at that moment. Pitiless is the right word for a movie like this. And I think Eastwood kind of, even to this day, though it's a lot more sentimental now than it was back in 66 or whatever, there is something that he doesn't give a lot. And because he doesn't give a lot, he's more mysterious and you kind of lean in out of curiosity as opposed to like him providing you all the clues about how to feel about his character.
Yeah, he's basically been negging American audiences for 50 years.
Before, right? It was such a term, he,
yes,
he saw the future of, yeah, of Twitter, of Twitter language, and understood.
Yeah, what a future that, yeah, was.
Why did you ghost me, Clint Eastwood? Tell me, why did you ghost me?
All right, so Good, Bad, and Ugly. I'm glad we watched that. I'm sorry it took so long for us to get to the reboot, but that was a good one. That was worth waiting for. That was a good one. All right, so that's our show, Grierson, this week. We have one new movie next week, and it's not The Curse of Lola or whatever it is.
Though I will be seeing that this week and reviewing it for Screen International. Yes, I.
That's which horror franchise is that connected to? The Conjuring.
The Conjuring. It's part of the Conjuring universe. Yes.
So many.
Well, maybe you and I are in the Conjuring universe, and we don't even know.
Yeah, it's the Conjuring universe. I'm just a squirrel trying.
Right.
To get
that reminds me, by the way, when someone does the gritty reboot of our podcast and is an R-rated like bloodfest and gory, what will that be like?
Well, that's
shudder to think.
That's an interesting thought. I am quite shuddering. All right, so we have one new movie to talk about next week, and that movie is Under the Silver Lake. Under the Silver Lake is written and directed by David Robert Mitchell, who did It Follows, the very well-received It Follows from 2014. Also did the not quite as well-received, but pretty well-received, The Myth of the American Sleepover.
Yeah,
this is
good movie. Yeah, I like Myth a lot. That's a good movie.
I know. I'm not ripping it. I'm just saying that like people really loved It Follows, and they also liked it was the first movie. Virgin, I've never even heard of that movie, so that must have been not as well-received.
Anyway. I actually thought Myth of the American Sleepover was his first film. I was not aware that there was.
According to Wikipedia, it is 2002's Virgin. Oh, it's a short film, so okay. That's probably why I didn't see it. Anyway, so Under the Silver Lake, written and directed by David Robert Mitchell, starring Andrew Garfield and Riley Keough. I have to say, the first I saw a trailer for this like a year ago and actually seemed kind of excited. This played at Cannes last year, but is just now, almost a year later, getting released.
Yes, it premiered at Cannes last year. It was supposed to come out through A24 like November of last year. Then they decided to push it to April, and now it is coming out next Friday.
Next Friday. Okay, so Under the Silver Lake. You saw it at Cannes?
I actually saw it before Cannes, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. So we'll be discussing that. That'll be kind of, I'm curious. I'm definitely curious about that. Okay. So then we have two reboot movies. The first reboot movie is 1997's Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, Burt Reynolds, Don Cheadle, William H. Macy, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you people, Heather Graham, you know Boogie Nights. For crying out loud. We all know Boogie Nights. I'm proud to say, I mean, I don't know. I won't tell my Boogie Nights story. I'll tell my Boogie Nights story next week.
Oh, it's been a while. Teasing us with the Boogie Nights story.
It's been a while. It's been a while since I saw Boogie Nights. But I to tease the story, I first saw Boogie Nights about 6 months before, literally anyone had seen Boogie Nights, because I was supposed to interview Mark Wahlberg for You, the National College Magazine.
You remember?
I just moved to, that college magazine that was inside college newspapers. It came out once a month called You. I used to write for that. That's why I moved to Los Angeles. I hung out with Grierson and got to be his Ron Livingston to his Jon Favreau for a year.
that was good casting on our part.
Yeah. I had to play, you made me wear the goofy suit. Anyway.
Wait, who is the Vince Vaughn? Actually, don't answer that question. Please continue with your story.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not answering that question. There was definitely not one. Anyway, the point is I saw this movie. I was supposed to interview Mark Wahlberg, or Marky Mark. I didn't even know he had a last name. And so I saw this movie literally I'm just telling the story now. Screw it. I literally saw this in a screening room with one publicist who invited me in, and Paul Thomas Anderson. The three of us at the New Line screening room on Robertson. Remember that, Grierson?
I do remember it. It is long, long gone. Yes. But yes, I was actually at the restaurant that's actually nearby at their day saying, New Line used to be there a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, like the was in the newsroom, the old
Your memory
restaurant?
Is excellent. It is actually no longer the newsroom. I went a blank on the restaurant, but I actually ate there just a few weeks ago.
Stories from Will's 1 year in Los Angeles 22 years ago.
That's welcome to the hell of this podcast. You start with Wilco ephemera, and then you end with Tim and Will reminiscing about Los Angeles in the late 1990s.
Anyway, the point is I had not seen Heart 8. I did not know Paul Thomas Anderson at all, and he literally walked in. It was me, the publicist. I think it was one person in the back that I didn't even know who they were. He walked in and said, "Here's my movie. It's not quite done. My name is P.T. Anderson." He called himself P.T. Anderson. He said, "My name is P.T. Anderson. This movie's not quite done, but I know you need to see it to interview Mark. So I hope you like it." And then he sat and watched the movie two rows in front of me. And it was not done. In fact, there were moments that there was a blank screen for a couple of seconds, or they had some sort of shot they needed to figure out or something. So that was how early I saw Boogie Nights. That's a long, long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
I suspect after Boogie Nights was released, he never had to do that again. I think that's he never had to go in and introduce his unfinished movie to a 21-year-old kid with feathered hair who was like, "Am I going to interview Marky Mark?"
That was a good impression of what your voice sounded like back then. I don't think I remember that story. In fact, I'm sure I don't remember that story. Yeah. I remember you saw it early because we saw it then opening night, opening weekend together in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I had seen it. And
I think that was one of the crew. That was back when the whole crew, your whole film school crew. I think it was one of the movies I really went to go see.
I'm trying to remember. And I have not seen this movie in its entirety since then.
All right. Well, that should be interesting then. But Paul Thomas Anderson, he ended up doing some interesting things.
I hope he shows up when I watch the movie this week and says, "Hi, I live in the Valley, but I happen to notice you're going to be watching my movie."
Okay. And our third movie, our final reboot movie next week is 1989's The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, written and directed by Peter Greenaway. I don't think we've ever said Peter Greenaway's name on this podcast.
We have not. I don't feel like I need to do the research. I feel pretty confident. No, and I have never seen this movie, so I'm very excited.
I'm very excited to finally
have the excuse and the opportunity. My only memory of this movie was it was back in the bad old days of the, it's NC-17.
I thought it was Henry and June. Was it Henry and June? I think Henry and June was one of those.
That was also one of those movies where it's like, impressionable 14-year-olds that we were at the time, we weren't able
back,
to
back in the day where they're like, the world can't handle Fred Ward humping.
But it turned out the world was.
They were ready. All right.
Was he wearing our shirt while? We'll never know.
Okay. So I'm excited. I've also never seen that movie. I'm pretty fascinated by it. So I've always been curious about it. So I think I've only seen one of his movies. I saw the one with Ewan McGregor.
The name is going to escape me completely. But
yeah,
yes.
Hang on. I'm going to look it up. The one with Ewan McGregor where I remember it because it was The Pillow Book. That's what it
okay,
was.
Okay, yes, The Pillow Book. I haven't seen...
Or a.k.a. the movie where Ewan McGregor sewed his Ewan McGregor.
Yes, I've never seen Dreading by Numbers, yes. My lovely wife has seen this movie because she's cooler than I am, but I have not yet seen it. So we'll discuss it next week. Speaking of potentially disgusting, shocking things, we'll discuss that next week.
Yes, exactly. All right, so next week, Under the Silver Lake, Boogie Nights, and The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Have a great week, Grierson. Enjoy. Oh, by the way, can you believe we got this far in the podcast? And bobblehead Jeff Tweedy never showed up. Come with me.
Well.
Come with me.
Oh.
You have to please be patient with me.
The rights for Wilco songs are prohibitively expensive. Be careful, Will, when you're doing this stuff. I believe he's under the weather somewhat recently. I feel like I read that somewhere. So, Jeff Tweedy, if you're listening to this, I hope you're feeling better.
He played in Atlanta. He played. I missed it because my wife was out of town. I was just hanging out with the boys, so I did not get the chance to go see him. John Hamm introduced him. St. Louis Cardinals fans, John Hamm. We should go. All right, Grierson, have a good week. Well, I'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works because of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works because of us.
Okay, so all right, so here is the thing that the staff decided to do.
Yeah.
Because you are so good at delivering insults on Veep. I do not know what these are, but they have written 5 Veep-esque insults for you to deliver about me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? You're already laughing.
They're good. They're good. Your staff is very talented. Right, they would be very welcome on
Veep. Okay, here we go. Hit me with the first one.
Okay, so you look like a limp handshake.
You started off small.
I'm telling you, man. I'm doing the best I can.
Okay, let's see if I posture up. Posture up. We can do this.
And this is one of my favorites.
Find my centered place.
You corny, quizzical hayseed. The closest you've ever been to an Emmy is sitting next to me.
Okay.
Being the co-founder of Deadspin, I mean, come on. That's like saying you gave birth to Rosemary's Baby. You created something truly evil.
Great. Actually, not even the co-founder. I actually did the whole thing. No.
You look like the type of guy who would put his finger on his own lips to shush himself.
Oh, that's definitely true. Since I get very carried away.
You know, God, this show would be so much better if it was called The Will Leach Dies and Only Has One Episode Show. Oh. And that's just mean. Okay, what next?
Okay, how many more of these are there? There's a lot.
They prepped me. There was a stack. I tried to whittle it down. Your wife must be deaf because, my God.
Oh, yikes.
Withering. Your staff loves you.
Uh-huh, keep going.
And this is another one. And your wife gets to play a part in this one, too.
Wonderful.
It's like, You look like you'd still be nervous to ask your wife out on a date.
Okay, that one is actually true and probably written by my wife.
She, and we have another surprise for you.
No, no.
Come on.
She was supposed to come on stage, but she left you.